How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me,
the genes of you and me,
we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA. We're all made of DNA.
Hi, you're listening to DNA Today, a multi-award-winning podcast and radio show where we discover new advances in the world of genetics. From genetic technology like CRISPR to rare diseases to new research, for over a decade, DNA Today has brought you the voices of leaders in genetics in over 200 episodes. For the past 3 years, DNA Today has won the People's Choice Best Science and Medicine Podcast Award. I'm Kira Dineen. I'm a certified genetic counselor and your host. Which muscular dystrophy causes weakness of the muscles, typically starting around the hips and shoulders? That would be limb-girdle muscular dystrophy, or LGMD. LGMD is a group of neuromuscular diseases caused by mutations in genes responsible for proteins critical for muscle function, regulation, and repair. Sarepta is a global biotechnology company working on engineering precision genetic medicine with the goal of changing the lives of people living with rare muscular dystrophies. Their multi-platform precision genetic medicine engine includes gene therapy, RNA, and gene editing approaches. And that reminds me, ACMG is in March and Sarepta will be at booth 504. You can also head over to limbgirdle.com to learn more. Again, that's limbgirdle.com. Surely you've heard of whole genome sequencing, but what about rapid and ultra-rapid whole genome sequencing? This is an emerging method of diagnosing genetic conditions for quick management. PerkinElmer Genomics offers this incredibly valuable test, which can be life-saving for ill babies and kids. Learn more in our full episode with PerkinElmer Genomics on here, DNA Today. You can visit PerkinElmerGenomics.com for more information. The link is also available in the show notes and on our website, DNAtoday.com. We're exploring limb-girdle muscular dystrophy in this episode. Joining me for this conversation are two experts, not just one, but two experts in the field of muscular dystrophy. We have Dr. Luis Rodina Claypack, who is the Executive Vice President, Head of Research and Development, and Chief Scientific Officer at Sarepta Therapeutics, who has 15 years of experience researching and studying limb-girdle muscular dystrophy. Livia Medna is a senior genetic counselor and systems director of genetic counseling at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, which many of you probably know as CHOP. She has 15 years also of experience in pediatric neuromuscular diagnoses, including limb-girdle muscular dystrophy. So thank you both for taking the time to come on the show and help me explore limb-girdle muscular dystrophy today.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
And the second time we've recorded together, which is awesome. But as we said, we're talking about limb-girdle muscular dystrophy, which is a neuromuscular disorder that causes weakness and wasting of the muscles. Livia, I thought we could start with you just talking a little bit about, you know, as we mentioned, you have an expertise in muscular dystrophies. So talking about limb-girdle, what muscles are typically affected first? When do symptoms usually start for people? And I imagine it's a bit of a range.
Yes. So limb-girdle muscular dystrophy is not one condition, but rather a group of conditions that follow a similar pattern of muscle involvement. So number one, it's very clear that limb-girdle muscular dystrophy is a genetic condition. It's not an acquired, it's not autoimmune, it's not otherwise mediated. It is a genetic condition. Second, it is a condition that primarily affects the skeletal muscle, which is a predominantly affected muscle, and it affects it in a specific pattern, first targeting the muscles that are closer to the core of the body. Those would be the shoulder girdle and the hip girdle muscles. Thus the limb girdle name. And the weakness has to be slowly progressive, not rapidly progressive. And eventually more distal muscles can also become involved. Individuals also have elevated creatine kinase levels in their serum, which is a marker of muscle breakdown. All of us have some level of creatine kinase in our bloodstream because we use muscles, we break down muscles by exercising. But when that breakdown is ongoing, that marker is considerably elevated, and that's a true sign of muscular dystrophy. And the changes are progressive, and that's visible on two other aspects, and that's visible on the what we call histology, muscle biopsy when that is done, and that's also visible on something that we do more frequently now than 20 years ago, and that's muscle imaging. Looking at muscle by ultrasound or MRI, those degenerative changes are seen. So when we take that all together, we can recognize a pattern that fits the limb girdle muscular dystrophies. And you asked the first question, when is the age of onset? It's incredibly variable. There are forms of limb girdle muscular dystrophy that have age of onset during the first decade of life, 5 to 7 years of age, perhaps in some cases even a little bit earlier. But there are forms of limb girdle muscular dystrophy where individuals notice muscle weakness only in their fifth or sixth decade.
Wow, that is a huge variability. And you work mostly in the pediatric space. So a lot of patients that you're seeing are more the kid age. And there's just so many different types within limb girdle. So when you're looking at this, someone has a muscular dystrophy. Obviously, you don't know which one it is as you're going through like the diagnostic odyssey there. What makes it stand out that you're like, oh, this is a sign that I'm really thinking it could be limb girdle as opposed to there's a lot of muscular dystrophies?
It's important that evaluation is done in experienced centers where there are pediatric or adult neuromuscular specialists, so neurologists with additional training in neuromuscular conditions who work generally in teams, maybe with physical therapists or occupational therapists that are also skilled in evaluating various muscle groups. And more increasingly, the larger neuromuscular centers include genetic counselors to help guide genetic testing. Whereas 15, 20 years ago, the evaluation started with an EMG, electromyography, and nerve conduction studies, and often a muscle biopsy. This day and age, we really want to see that elevated creatine kinase level to really show there's ongoing muscle breakdown. But then the next step, often with the same blood draw, saving the specimen, is the genetic test. It's much more non-invasive. It's definitely specific. The changes on histology, on muscle biopsy, can be specific for certain types or subtypes of limb girdle muscular dystrophy, especially if those proteins are expressed at the muscle cell membrane. However, in many cases and other subtypes of limb girdle muscular dystrophy, one sees dystrophic changes, changes in the muscle that are reflective of muscle undergoing breakdown. There's fatty tissue replacement, connective tissue replacement, but they're not specific to one category. So genetic testing has really moved as the tier one diagnostic test following really good and proper physical examination and that creatine kinase enzyme level.
Yeah, so it sounds like it's really those three aspects. It's the CK level, and then looking at the genetic testing, and then looking at the physical too, of just evaluating that child, teenager, adult, depending on the type. So then when it comes to the genetic testing, is it usually a panel that's ordered? Because, you know, now a lot of testing is moving more into whole genome, whole exome. But is it still like a limb girdle panel or a muscular dystrophy panel that providers are ordering if they know, okay, we have a muscle issue happening?
Most providers will these days go with a muscular dystrophy panel, or sometimes other commercial labs will call it limb girdle pattern weakness gene panel. And the advantage of gene panel is that there's capture of the sequences of the known genes that cause the various subtypes of limb girdle muscular dystrophies, and it's done in one test instead of going through stepwise approach. Exome or genome sequencing are wonderful tools, but not necessarily needed for workup of limb girdle muscular dystrophy, as in many cases, the diagnosis can be achieved by a comprehensive panel that does include the known genes for the subtypes of limb girdle muscular dystrophy. Exome sequencing has its role. It can identify cases that are maybe more complex, where muscle involvement is part of broader systemic disease. And of course, exome genome sequencing are also tools that are used to discover genetic causes of the yet unknown subtypes of limb girdle muscular dystrophy presentation.
So if providers are ordering a panel, then that's kind of, you're saying, the standard approach. From that result, are we able to say, oh, you have, like, let's say limb girdle comes back. Are we able to then identify and say, you have this type? and give more information at that point? Or do we need a little bit more testing and variant curation to get to that point?
That's an excellent question. I think the answer is not unique to muscular dystrophies, but to all genetic tests. So in many cases, the answer is very straightforward because the pathogenic gene variant is very clear, either because it's recurrent or it's pathogenic by nature because it's, for example, a loss of function allele due to a splice site or frame shift or nonsense variant. At other times, the variant is unique, and then we do need to put some work in to arrive at a diagnosis or maybe dismiss that variant. So I think most of us who work in this field really take a stepwise approach. And I think that's the right approach when there is no slam dunk definitive answer. And that's number one, the phenotype. Number two, the genotype. You know, does the genotype fit? And if the variant is novel, how do you assess that? Well, then we go to the imaging and see, does the imaging fit any known pattern? And that can be by ultrasound or MRI. Then we also like to go to the histotype. So muscle biopsy, while no longer being the first step in diagnostic evaluation, is an absolutely useful tool and a diagnostic workup step that is used. And in this day and age, we tend to use muscle biopsy to clarify variants of unknown significance to see if the muscle itself looks similar to what's expected for that gene pathogenic changes in one particular gene. So we go with phenotype, we go with genotype, we go with histotype, and the word imaging, I can't turn it into a type, but imaging also is very important to provide that. Once you have those four aspects aligning, then we can come up with a diagnosis working together with a team.
And one aspect that I know if parents are listening or caregivers, it's like, okay, well, this sounds really expensive. You know, as a genetic counselor, I'm sure you're involved with ordering this testing as well as being involved with patient care. Is there only genetic testing available like through insurance companies and cash options? Is there any programs that are running where there's not a cost to the patient themselves?
That's an excellent question. I think this day and age, there are multiple avenues how to achieve a molecular diagnosis. Traditional one is a test order through a clinic by a provider that's billed to insurance. In most cases, it requires an insurance authorization. But limb-girdle muscular dystrophies, just like other neuromuscular diagnoses, have a relatively easy way to achieve insurance authorization when the letter of medical necessity is written correctly. Insurance companies are not looking to validate testing for academic purposes or to approve testing. They approve testing when arriving at a genetic diagnosis impacts management. So those of us in the field who've been in the field for a couple decades plus have kind of fine-tuned that skill. And for neuromuscular conditions, knowing the diagnosis absolutely impacts management while we wait for more targeted, more curative treatment. Not every individual with every type of limb-girdle muscular dystrophy needs ongoing surveillance for cardiomyopathy or cardiac arrhythmias. Not every individual with LGMD needs monitoring for nocturnal hypoventilation. So that's difficulties maintaining oxygenation during sleep when someone is laying down supine and relying just on the diaphragm as opposed to diaphragm and our intercostal muscles, our chest muscles as well. But those who do, for those individuals, it's critically important to catch that, to diagnose it timely, and to treat it because heart conditions, breathing conditions can be treated appropriately even in the settings where we cannot treat the underlying muscle pathology yet. So that's one approach is really having your providers write letters of medical necessity that demonstrate that arriving at diagnosis will impact management. Insurance companies not interested for paying for yearly echocardiograms from age 23 until throughout lifetime if that's not necessary. But there are also other programs. There are industry-supported programs at certain commercial laboratories where clinicians need to fill out form attesting that an individual meets criteria for a limb-girdle type muscular dystrophy that generally involves the presentation of the features we discussed, muscle weakness, elevated creatine kinase level, perhaps a family history also of muscular dystrophy. And there are these sponsored programs that are available at no cost at all. And for some individuals, some commercial laboratories are also offering relatively price-friendly options, you know, where it's not covered by insurance, but an individual pays out of pocket. That price or those charges have dropped over the last 10 years from that being, you know, well above $1,000, $2,000 to now the prices being in a few hundred dollars. So, of course, everyone has a different financial situation, but I think this day and age, there should be ability to achieve a genetic diagnosis if one can be identified to date with the various testing options that are available to the providers and to patients.
And we see how important that is, as you talked about, of knowing, okay, you have this subtype, so this is important because we need to do this type of care, or we don't have to do this type of care or surveillance. I've enjoyed recording a few episodes about epigenetics. One of the interviews where I learned the most was with the diagnostic labs at the Greenwood Genetic Center. They taught me about EpiSign, which is a novel clinically validated test that analyzes methylation. I just learned that since this episode aired in 2021, version 4 of EpiSign has been released, which has expanded to include over 70 conditions. If you're attending ACMG this month, stop by booth 607 to chat with Greenwood Genetics. In the meantime, brush up on your epigenetics by listening to episode 145 of DNA Today and visit ggc.org, link in the show notes. Genetic technology moves fast. The first genome took 13 years to finish a draft. For reference, this was 20 years ago in 2003. And now a whole genome sequence can be performed in days, even hours. Since sequencing an entire genome can be done in such a short amount of time, this lowers the cost, which means more people can utilize whole genome sequencing now. This is particularly helpful in the NICU for ill infants. PerkinElmer Genomics explained more to me in our full episode here on DNA Today. It is remarkable how quick diagnosis from whole genome sequencing can save a baby's life with a change in treatment informed from the results of that test. I learned more about how genome data is mined to maximize useful information from one data set and other omic assays that help enhance diagnosis. Don't miss the full episode here on DNA Today. You can visit PerkinElmerGenomics.com for more information. The link is also available in the show notes and on our website, DNAtoday.com. So, Louise, I'd love to pull you in and hear your expertise. Coming from Sarepta, you guys have a gene therapy program for, what is it, the 6 most common subtype?
Yeah, that's correct.
This covers the majority of limb-girdle, those 6 subtypes.
Yeah, the subtypes that we are researching at Sarepta cover about 70% of the limb-girdle population. And it's our goal, and you know, as we've talked about, the importance of genetic subtyping is to deliver a newly functioning version of that gene to make the protein that's missing. So the subtypes that we work on are LGMD2B, 2C, 2A, 2E, 2L. I got them all.
Yeah. Nice.
It's a nice list.
Had to rattle them off, right?
Yeah.
Explain to me a little bit more about how the gene therapy works. So you're providing a gene that, you know, quote unquote works, as opposed to the broken gene that they have, and that's how they have this diagnosis. From my limited exposure to this, researching, you know, to prepare for this episode, I learned there's kind of 3 main components to gene therapy. Could you walk us through what those components are?
Yes, absolutely. I think just to talk about gene therapy in general, it's you're delivering a normal functioning copy of the gene. You're not altering the genome of the body. So you're not doing anything to the chromosomes or genes that the person has. You're adding a new copy of that. And so the 3 main components are called a vector. And really what the vector is just it's a virus that's found in nature that's naturally occurring, but we modify it so that it doesn't replicate on its own. We're just kind of capitalizing on its ability to get where we want it to in the body, in this case, muscle. So that's the vector part. So we deliver it through the bloodstream, through an IV, to get to muscle. The second component is called a promoter, and this is like an on and off switch. So when we deliver the vector to the body, it goes not just to muscle, it goes other places, but we only want to express the gene and the protein in muscle. So we use a muscle-specific promoter to turn it on in muscle. And then the last part is called the transgene. And in the cases of limb-girdle, this is just a full wild-type version or a normal version of the gene, which then makes the protein that's missing or not functional.
So with this gene therapy, then it's going to differ depending on those subtypes, I imagine. We talked about, you know, the most common six is what you guys are focused on at Sarepta. So how does that differ between subtypes? Because if you're delivering, you know, a quote unquote normal wild type, like just if you looked at my genome, you said, oh, okay, this is probably just like a typical one, right? So how does it differ between subtypes if you're just providing that healthy gene, I guess we can call it?
Right. So each limb-girdle subtype is a mutation in a different gene. So each one is tailored specific for that subtype. That's why knowing your genetic diagnosis is so important. I think many years ago, genetic testing wasn't done because at that point there was no options for gene therapy. You know, this is going back decades. But now it's incredibly important because you obviously can't deliver the wrong gene to a patient with a different mutation in a different gene. And so it's incredibly important to know your genetic diagnosis so you can be treated appropriately.
And important to know, as I just missed, that there's different genes for these different subtypes. It's not one limb-girdle gene, so that's important. And that makes sense because I'm looking back in my head at, like, carrier screening reports. Like, yes, there's a but. It's limb-girdle, like, so many times on carrier screening. And I'm like, that's because there's different genes. So, okay, thank you for patiently explaining that to me. So for gene therapy then, so that's how it works. What is the goal? Like, what do we want to see if a patient is being administered with this gene therapy, what do we want to see in terms of outcome for them?
So the goal is to stabilize or slow the progression of the disease. Depending on what time you intervene in treatment, it could be better if it's earlier in the disease process versus later. And so that's why doing things like this and getting the word out about genetic diagnosis is important. And as more therapies become available for clinical trial, it's important to know that so that you can intervene as early as possible.
Certainly to be able to pause the symptoms where they are so that it's not developing any further. And we see that with other types of, you know, gene therapy treatments, that if we can administer it even before symptoms are present, that's like super ideal, which isn't always realistic though. You know, you mentioned clinical trials. Is that the status that gene therapy is in right now, specifically for limb-girdle? Or are we looking at clinical trials?
There are a number of clinical trials. As I mentioned, these are a group of disorders, so there's clinical trials for different subtypes. So the best way to go about is go to clinicaltrials.gov, search for your subtype, and then ultimately always you should talk to your doctor about what trials are best for you.
Very good advice. Everybody should bookmark that because just about every guest that comes on mentions that link, so we'll throw it in the show notes for people.
Yeah.
When do you expect getting through these clinical trials? Obviously, things have to happen and certain things have to be approved. Let's say you guys get great results. When would you expect FDA to approve that so that it's widely available so that a healthcare provider could prescribe that to a patient that's been identified? Or like, let's say in my case, I'm meeting with a couple, they're both a carrier and they're continuing the pregnancy. We're going to, you know, say test the baby once the baby's born and we're identifying, okay, they have limb-girdle. Like how soon would I be able to tell patients, like, you know, we're expecting maybe in this range of time, which I imagine is going to be a range. You don't have a crystal ball to say it's going to be exactly this year.
Yeah, it's a difficult question to ask. Right now, we have trials for a small number of subtypes. They're in phase one clinical trials, which means these are the early studies that evaluate safety and early signs of efficacy, and then before going to what's called a phase three, which is a larger study. Then the next decade, we're hopeful, but it's hard to give a range at this point.
Yeah, very, very understandable.
A lot of us face is that patients ask, well, what can I do now while scientists are still working on fine-tuning the gene therapy treatments, on making sure that they're safe and that they are able to deliver what their promise is there to deliver? So I think from the very clinical perspective, I always encourage all my patients to join a registry. Registries are critical to establish really scientifically based, factually based natural history for that condition when it is untreated in terms of looking at the primary muscle disease process. Of course, individuals who register with these natural history studies are treated with conventional methods. Their hearts are treated. Their breathing apparatus, if that's affected, is treated. But the skeletal muscle itself cannot be treated without the more advanced therapies that are in development. These natural history studies are absolutely critical because one needs to show that the intervention, be it gene therapy, RNA-based therapy, or another therapy, is making a difference. It is impacting the natural history of the disease process. And one cannot demonstrate that if patients are not well characterized before that treatment arrives.
And I think that's exactly right. And at Sarepta, we're doing a number of things. While we're doing the research, we're also sponsoring a number of natural history studies. One is with the GRASP LGMD Consortium, which sponsors studying patients with LGMD 2C, 2E, 2D. We also collaborate with the Jane Foundation, which specifically looks at LGMD 2B, or dysferlin deficiency. And then lastly, we have a sponsor study called Journey, where we're looking at a number of LGMD subtypes so that we can support the programs that we're working on forward. But absolutely, natural history studies are crucial in these rare disease indications, especially so that we can understand the population and design the best trials to determine outcomes.
And I really encourage people, if they have a diagnosis, to ask their healthcare provider if there is a study that they can be a part of so that they can help with these natural history studies, so they can be raise that N number so we have even more participants and those statistics are even more meaningful there. For patients that do are interested in accessing the gene therapy programs, is there a way that their healthcare providers can help them enroll in this or see if they're even eligible?
Right. If you go to clinicaltrials.gov, that has all the information, has the site contact for the physicians participating in that trial. They can contact that way and find out what they need to do for screening.
Fantastic. And as we wrap up, my last question is there anything we didn't cover in terms of any myths about limb-girdle that you guys wanted to clarify?
I'd say for me, we talked about it. It's just that the limb-girdle is a general diagnosis. Now we know it's a collection of disorders with similar phenotypes, but not the same. Each one is a distinct gene that is altered, and that it's important to know your diagnosis so that we can best find treatments and path forward for patients. But we're optimistic about what we can do for limb-girdle, and I think the journey of genetic diagnosis, natural history studies will help us.
Well, thank you both so much for coming on and sharing so much with our audience and myself, just educating me on how all of this works. I'm really intrigued to see, you know, the natural history studies once those are published and how the gene therapy is progressing over the years. So thank you so much for all of your work in muscular dystrophies over, you know, 15 plus years for each of you. So we've got, you know, 30 years plus of experience just in this one episode. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it. This has been a very interesting episode.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us on.
Which muscular dystrophy causes weakness of the muscles, typically starting around the hips and shoulders? That would be limb-girdle muscular dystrophy, or LGMD. LGMD is a group of neuromuscular diseases caused by mutations in genes responsible for proteins critical for muscle function, regulation, and repair. Sarepta is a global biotechnology company working on engineering precision genetic medicine with the goal of changing the lives of people living with rare muscular dystrophies. Their multi-platform precision genetic medicine engine includes gene therapy, RNA, and gene editing approaches. And that reminds me, ACMG is in March and Sarepta will be at booth 504. You can also head over to limbgirdle.com to learn more. Again, that's limbgirdle.com. Do you remember the DNA Today episode about epigenetic tests? It was with Greenwood Genetic Center's Dr. Ray Louie and genetic counselor Kelly Walden. We chatted about testing for epigenetic conditions and specifically their diagnostic lab's test, EpiSign. EpiSign included 40 conditions during this initial interview in 2021. So I'm so excited to share with you that version 4 is now available and includes over 70 conditions. They sure have made a lot of great strides in that time. For those that haven't listened to this episode yet, the diagnostic lab at the Greenwood Genetic Center is the only lab in the country to offer this epigenetic test called EpiSign. It's a novel, clinically validated test that analyzes methylation. If you're attending ACMG later this month in Salt Lake City, I recommend stopping by booth 607 to chat with Greenwood to learn more. Brush up on your epigenetics before that by listening to episode 145 of DNA Today and visit ggc.org. Links in the show notes. For more information about today's episode, visit dnatoday.com, where you can also stream all 200 plus episodes of the show, including video versions of interviews recorded in 2021 or later. Any questions, episode ideas, guest pitches, or sponsor inquiries can be sent into info@dnatoday.com. Be sure to follow us on social media, especially so you don't miss a giveaway. We are at DNA Today Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, and more. Please rate and review the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. This truly helps us climb the charts and allow more genetic nerds like yourself to find the show. Here's a bonus. If you do and send us a screenshot, I'll give you a shout out on the show. DNA Today is created, hosted, and produced by myself, Kira Dineen. Our team includes communications lead, Corinne Merlino, video lead, Amanda Andrioli, outreach intern, Sonia Tanaker, social media intern, Kajal Patel, and graphic designer, Ashlyn Anokian. Thanks for listening, and join us next time to discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA. We're all made